Again, it is good to see so many people this evening. The last talk for almost 3 months. But you can always see some golden oldies on YouTube. Or for those who are really, really desperate, you can always come to monastery. Or even better, as I'm sure Dennis will announce, if you haven't seen already, on the 12th of August at Curtin University. That's just about a month from now. So if you're really sort of desperate, in 4 weeks' time, we are giving a talk at Curtin University in the evening, on Wednesday evening, 7 to 8. Ajahn Brahm versus Archbishop Hurft, the Anglican Archbishop. The gloves will be on. No, just have a good time. On the subject, if Jesus met the Buddha, what would they say to each other? I know what the Buddha would say. He'd say, turning water into wine, that's breaking your precepts. Anyway, tonight's talk, I wanted to do a special talk this evening, not just because it's the last talk, but because for those of you who were here last week, who stayed behind, you would have noticed there's some excitement as one of the members who've been coming for a while, just talking to me, just passed out and died. So he died, actually, just right where this gentleman is sitting right now. But his name was Robert, and here he was a member. And I sort of dedicate this talk to him. It's a wonderful thing to do, because given me the privilege, I've had that privilege several times of being with somebody and watching them die. And it's not something which you're afraid of. It's not something which you're disturbed by. But it's something which is a very beautiful moment in a person's life and journey, the moment of their death. And so the topic for this evening's talk is how to die well, by living well. And of course, you know, we all know we're going to die one day, but it's a nice reflection which the Buddha kept on asking the monks and any Buddhist to keep reminding yourself that one day you will die. And what it does, it means that we learn how to live well. And a person who lives well, I've seen this so many times, you know, because this is part of my life. I have a really interesting job of being a monk. I can really recommend it, a monk or a nun. It's sort of a lifestyle which people just don't appreciate. It's not just sitting in your cave all day meditating, although I'll be doing a lot of that in the next 3 months. Sometimes, you know, you're with people when they're dying, go into prisons. You know, you can actually meet the queen, and then you can just work sort of, you know, in the gutters with all the other monks, getting yourself filthy dirty. And you have all this amazing life, you know, going in the ICU unit, you know, meet all these interesting people like Roger Penrose, discoverer of black holes, and having dinner with him, and I just had some chocolate. But I've got a bit of a black hole in here when it comes to chocolate. It just disappears down my throat, I don't know where it goes. And all these other really interesting people which you get to meet as a monk. But one of the things which I really enjoy, and you may feel it's a strange thing to say this, is being at funeral services. Because there we're reminded about the important things in life and how a person can live well. And again, I've always noticed that people who live beautifully, in other words, they're kind, they're generous, and they understand what's important in life. These are the people, you see them when they're dying, and you're with them through that whole process. And they die beautifully, gracefully, inspiringly. You know why they do that? Because they've lived well. They have been kind. They have been gentle. And that attitude by which they've lived their life, there it's for them when they die. And that's why I have this beautiful opportunity of seeing so many incredibly wonderful people in that dying process. And you're with them, and it's not painful at all. It's as if you're being with a person. Sometimes I give the simile, like the symphonies. I used to love music before I was a monk. It's one of those things you can't do as a monk, listen to music, except one of the exceptions is in funeral services, because every now and again they play the person's favourite music. And because I'm that age now, that many people of my age are dying, when they play the favourite music at a funeral service, sometimes it's the music I used to like. So I remember just going to this one funeral service, I think last year, and they were playing Jimi Hendrix, because that's what the guy liked when he died, and that's what I used to like. So as you get to this sort of age, and people of my age are popping off, I get to listen to this music, which I wouldn't be able to listen to otherwise. So anyway, I like the idea of a symphony because I know the great symphonies, and they have this theme and they just build up this beautiful crescendo, which is at the very end. And then that's like a person's life. And sometimes that crescendo is just the last moments of life when they're with their family and loved ones. And you can see just what a beautiful life they've lived. I think, wow, that was just an amazing performance. And I've used that simile of performances and music and symphonies so often to describe a life. And it has a beginning and it's beautiful as it builds up the theme of your life. And when it gets to the very end, this incredible crescendo, and then it's over, it's finished. And I use that simile so often in talking about death and dying. Because those of you who know this simile, because I often say it at most funeral services, but I never actually said it yesterday for the funeral service of Robert. And it's a beautiful simile, because it is real, it doesn't come from the books, it comes from, actually even from my book, but it comes from my life, when my father died. I was 16 years of age when he died. And I've talked about my father a lot, he was a very inspirational figure. Little things about, you know, his life when he was a young boy, born in Liverpool during the Depression years. And he always used to, you know, actually he hardly ever talked about his father, except when I pressed him once. And he told me why I never liked to talk about his dad, my paternal grandfather. And please excuse the language here, but you have to say this. My father called his father a bastard. And I asked, why are you talking to your father, my paternal grandfather, like that? And he said, because during the Depression years it was so tough. And my paternal grandfather was a plumber. And if he got whatever money he got, he would take down the pub and come home drunk, get out his belt, and he'd beat any kid in his path for any reason and then turn on his wife, my dad's mum. He was a perpetrator of very gross domestic violence, the sort of thing which will send a person to jail if he did that sort of stuff today. But that was my father's father. But one thing which he told me, which I was really respected him, and it challenged some of the usual ways of we look at things in our modern age. He said whenever he was at the end of that belt being whipped, he said he made a resolution. He determined if ever he had kids, he would never beat them. And he never would. He couldn't. He never visited the violence which he had received on myself or my brother, because he understood what it meant, and the pain, not just the physical pain, so the emotional hurt which that gives a person. He realized that, he learned from it, and he grew into this wonderful person who would not beat me. He couldn't hurt his kids because he knew what it did. He learned from the pain which he had received in life. And sometimes when a person is a so-called victim, a recipient of abuse, of a pain, of difficulty, being cheated, being abused, you don't have to visit the same on other people. You can learn what I call the AFL code. You acknowledge, you don't hide it and push it down deep inside of you because you can't stand the pain. You're courageous enough to bring it up, to feel it, to forgive it, not with anger, and to learn from it, to grow from it. And that's why my father was just an incredibly loving man. And when he died, a person that I also told him when he told me about open the door of your heart, whatever you do in your life, son, remember one thing. The door of my house, which he meant his heart, will always be open to you, no matter what you ever do. That's the type of love which he gave me. So you can imagine when a person like that died. You missed my teacher, my inspiration. And I love my mother as well, but you know, my father was just the person who guided me in those early years. And he died when I was only 16. At home, it was wonderful actually to get up there and shake his body and trying to bring some life back into him. But he was dead. Maybe that was one of the great experiences of being with someone you've known, respected and loved, and seeing them dead. so I could understand and experience what life and death was. But being so close to it, acknowledging it, feeling it, I never felt sad. And this was a strange feeling for a 16-year-old, not to feel sad at the death of his father, who he loved a lot. At the funeral service, there was no tears. And I never cried once since that time. I cried of joy, I mean, never cried because of sadness that my father died. And of course, that was so strange. And when I did become a monk, I remembered that. And I thought, why was I showing no signs of grief? And looking inside, being a meditator and being mindful, investigating these things, I could understand exactly how I felt and why I felt it. But then I had to find some way of explaining it to myself. And so we always use similes. We use something similar from our life to explain some of these deep emotional feelings, which was quite strange. And so I came up, because of my love of music, with a simile of a concert. And I use this simile in just about every funeral service which I give, because it's meaningful and it gives people another way of looking at the meaning of life and the death, which always ends it. And it's a beautiful simile because it shows what I mean about how to die well is how to live well. And the simile of the concert goes like this. Again, growing up in London, a teenager, going to so many concerts and seeing, you know, great musicians, you know, you've probably heard all these stories, but going to see the Rolling Stones when I was only 11, and Mick Jagger prancing around, good fun. And seeing sort of the first concert of Led Zeppelin, the very first. They actually called themselves the New Yardbirds, first of all, the first concert. They changed their name a few days later, for those of you who want to know this trivia. But the story which usually makes people gasp is, I remember going to see this concert of this group in North London in a pub with my brother. And it was really disappointing because only about six people turned up to see this concert. And I'd assume that, you know, playing for six people, who want to play for six people? I thought the band would just pack up and go home. But they played for us. It's almost like a personal performance. And, you know, the band wasn't so famous, but the lead singer is now incredibly famous, Rod Stewart. And there he was, fronting a band, just playing for my brother, myself, and four other people. You wouldn't be able to do that these days. But these are the great memories I have. You know, and this was 40 years ago. I remember these occasions. But what I always remembered was after the performance, you know, it was in a club, sort of in a pub or in some great concert hall. You know, at the end of every performance, you'd stand up, clap and shout for more. You'd always do that. Maybe this evening, after my talk, you can stand up, clap, more, more. And who knows, it may go on for a few minutes. But they usually go on for a few minutes after the performance has ended. But then comes that time when the band, the performer, has to go home. And that's when I'd have to get out of the seat, maybe with your girlfriend or with other friends or by yourself, and you'd walk out of the concert hall or pub or club. And I always remember, those people who know London, it's always cold and gloomy in the evening, usually raining. And I always remember going out into the cold, dark, gloomy London night, knowing that the concert was finished, and the chances of hearing such great music again were very, very small. And I never once cried at the end of a great performance. I never even felt the tiny bit of sadness after the end of the great concert. Instead, I felt this beautiful feeling of privilege, of joy, how incredibly lucky I had been to be there and see these people perform. And the music was brilliant, it was inspiring. And it moved me so deeply, I knew I'd never forget that great performance. Even though it was over, I felt such incredible joy and inspiration. And that was precisely how I felt when I walked out of the service for my own father's funeral, when he died. What a wonderful performance that was, and how lucky I was to have known such a person for 16 years. And that's how I've regarded life and death from this time on, or that time on. You've had many friends, many people walking with you on the path of life, sometimes very close, spending many days together, sometimes just passing very briefly. But you enjoy the company of all these wonderful people. And so when they do go, thank you so much for sharing just a portion of your life with me. What a great performance that was. I will never ever forget you. And you don't. Now that's another way of looking at life and death. If it's not a good performance, and I've been to quite a few, I remember some bands who couldn't play for their life. You think, oh, I wasted such a lot of money. Then I was sad when I went out of the theatre. But that was usually the minority. And it's the same funeral services. I've done a few funeral services for people and I have been sad. And that's only because they haven't lived a good life. I think just what a waste of a life. What have you been doing all these years? And it's just life just going to work and making money and just getting your own way and being selfish and criticizing others and finding fault with life. And is that sort of what life is all about? No. Those beautiful people, which I've learned from, these have taught me probably so much about Buddhism. This is real life and how you live a beautiful life. And the ones who really inspired me, the great musicians, and I'm not talking about people who play guitars or play piano, I'm talking about you, ordinary people who may never pick up an instrument, the ones who can play the instrument of life and play it so beautifully. These are the ones who are just so kind and generous. People who wouldn't say a bad word about anybody. People who have this beautiful sense of softness, so the dog can bark, and oh, it's wonderful, never mind the dog barking. Or kids play during meditation. It's just kids being kids. It's not a big deal. Or someone sitting next to you falls asleep and starts snoring. Now, how much of a Buddhist are you? If you think that person is stopping me being enlightened, they're not stopping you being enlightened. You're stopping yourself being enlightened. You're not being kind. So if they're tired, let them sleep, let them snore. And if you can be so at peace and so kind with the person sitting next to you, letting off wind, and it's incredibly smelly, that means you're enlightened. You say, oh, isn't it wonderful? The door of my nose is open to... Now that's that sort of attitude. Those sorts of people, and there are those sorts of people around, they're the inspiring people. The sorts of people who have incredible difficulties in life, but actually learn from them and grow from them and become such beautiful people. These are the ones who learn how to live well. The people who are generous, and I don't just mean with money, I mean generous with the heart, this openness, this liberality, which just can forgive and forgive and forgive. And when people ask, how many times should you forgive? Someone asked me that many years ago, and so I gave them the correct answer. How many times should you forgive? Always one more time. Always forgive one more time. Just as like you would like to be forgiven one more time. Because a wise person understands human nature. Human nature is just like you, basically good, basically beautiful. That's why in Buddhism you're born in this human plane. Now you're really basically a good person, but sometimes the force is on you, the pressure's on you. Sometimes you do things, think, gee, why did I do that? That was a stupid thing to do. I wish I hadn't have done that. You make mistakes. And so when you make a mistake, what should you do about that? Acknowledge, forgive and learn, which is being kind to yourself. The last thing you should do is be a punisher, to punish yourself and punish other people. You've hurt me, therefore I have to hurt you back. That's not being a beautiful person. If you're somebody like that, when you die, you will want to punish yourself. This was a story which one of the German monks in my monastery, he read out in a book of people who could remember, had these near-death experiences, or NDEs. It's a great little resource for actually what happens to people when they die, because there are many, many people who, when they have some operation, they float out of their body during the operation, they basically die for a few minutes, and they can actually see and hear everything which is going on. I love these stories because they're true. There's so much evidence there. And if a person is reasonable, logical, they'll look at that evidence and look at it for yourself. I'm convinced, if I didn't know my mind myself, that when you die, this is what happens to you, floating out of your body, being able to see and hear everything which is going on. One of my favorite stories of this was of this English girl. She was wealthy, and she was just having like a minor procedure, but had to have it under anesthetic. But even under minor operations, there are complications sometimes. So this girl, having an operation, being wealthy, had this very polite doctor, you know, private health care. Whenever you pay that much money for a doctor, they are invariably very polite. Except during the operation, when they think that you're unconscious and when things go wrong. Because this doctor, you know, he's losing the patient, she was dying, and my goodness, if she dies, she won't be able to pay the bill. Maybe that was why he got a bit panicky. But I think it's more likely that, you know, she was dying on the operating table. And in the panic of trying to get her together, he shouted out these words, "Don't give up on me now, you bitch." That's what he said. Now, is any doctors here or nurses, be careful. Because she was listening. Floating out of her body, being able to see and hear everything which was going on. And obviously, you know, because she could tell the story, that they managed to fix up the problem, revive her, she survived the operation. And apparently in the first post-operation visit by the doctor, he came up to her and again in his very polite voice, "Madam, we came jolly close to losing you that time, but you know, we managed to pull you through." "Yes," she said, "but why did you call me a bitch?" "You were dead at the time." "No, I wasn't. I was watching. You better be careful next time that happens." And it was true. And she could see and hear everything which was going on. So when a person, you know, does die, you know that, you know, we know what's going on afterwards. And there's all this evidence. But this particular story, which came from a German book, and I love this story because it gives you an idea about how to die well. It was a story of like a young kid, and he may be only about 8, 9, 10 years of age, and he had a near-death experience. And the way he described it, remember, these are like mental experiences, and we add details to it. The core of the experience, you know, is real, but the way we describe it and the scenery which we give to these inner experiences, this is what we add on to this. So this is how the boy described it. He said, you know, he left his body and went on a long journey. He didn't know for how long. And he came to like a shed, he called it. And in the shed, there was a guy with a book, he said. And he asked my name, and he looked in there and said, "Your name's not in here. You're not supposed to be dead. You can go back. But oh, no, no, while you're here, you can just see what happens." And so another guy came through. And the next guy said, "What's your name?" He goes, "Oh, yeah, you're here, you're a farmer." And he said, "Have you ever killed any animals?" And he said, "Oh, no, no, only one or two, that's all." And he said, "See, even though he's dead, he lies through his teeth. He's killed this, this, this." So be careful. And then, as they were talking to this farmer, this other guy went straight past the shed. And this little German kid, say, he went straight past his head and went right up into the sky, you know, which was heaven realm. And the kid asks the guy with the book, aren't you going to ask him and check his name or what he's done? And the guy with the book said, I don't need to. That fellow never judged anybody throughout his whole life, therefore we're not going to judge him. And I love that story because now that is real. If you haven't judged anybody else, you've always been forgiving and kind and understanding. People do make mistakes. I make mistakes. You make mistakes. You've got this beautiful, like, patience and kindness towards other beings. Then you'll have the same attitude towards yourself when you die. You look at yourself and you won't judge yourself. Total forgiveness, total acceptance, total love for yourself. And of course, what sort of mind state is that? Remember, after you die, it's the mind which creates these realms. Your beautiful mind will create a beautiful space for you to be in. If you've got the negative, critical mind, oh, you're going to have a very critical and negative experience, you know, when you die. So this is how we understand this. It's this emotional wisdom, the ability to be kind, to be generous, to give yourself a break, for goodness sake. Now, if you can do that to others, that's how you do it to yourself. I do remember as an 18, 19-year-old, during the vacations from university. Even then, I was very inclined to being a Buddhist. And so, vacations, I used to go up to Scotland. It was the nearest uninhabited area in the north of Scotland, in the mountains. I used to go up there with a tent and just, you know, camp out there for days and meditate and live very simply. I loved that place. And so I remember once just walking down on a cliff edge and fell down the cliff. It was one of those amazing experiences because I had a heavy backpack on, not like these light backpacks you have in these days, you know, really heavy, you know, because they didn't have much lightweight, high-tech equipment. And because of the weight of my backpack, it turned me around and I was actually facing this vertical cliff, going down, 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 down. And I thought, this is going to be my end, I'm going to die. Because it was a long way down, a perfectly vertical cliff. And of course, you know, people say this, but I had that experience, you know, of my life flashing before me, all the important events. And what was really amazing was just how that experience, and maybe because of the adrenaline, I'm not sure what was happening in my brain, but time went really slowly. And then, next thing I knew, I could feel something solid under my feet. My legs automatically bent to take the fall, rolled over maybe once or twice, and got up. I was alive. And of course you check to make sure there's no broken bones. I couldn't see anything. Actually, it was, I think one nail had been half torn off, and that's all. And I stood up, and I saw the extent of the cliff. It was about 6 foot, that's all. That's true. But as I was falling, I was going so slow, it was past. It was like a 100-foot cliff to me. And that actually showed me just when you're in those very dangerous situations, life-threatening, just time and space get totally distorted. And I remember vividly that experience. But the interesting thing was you did start looking at your most important experience in life and you had an emotional reaction to those experiences. So the very kind ones which you had, the really good things which you have done in life, they created this beautiful sense of joy and inspiration. And the stupid, selfish things which I'd done, they actually came and, you felt a lot of pain about that. Which is why, you know, that if you have done, I never knew this at the time because I was still very young, I never knew that you can actually let go of the pain of the past and the stupid stuff which each one of us has done. We acknowledge it, we forgive it, and we learn from it, but we don't carry it into the future with us. So if you want to die well, you have the opportunity right now to let go of the pain of your past. To forgive it totally. All of the things which you should have done, which you didn't do. All the things which you shouldn't have done, but you did do. Come on, give yourself a break. Say, yeah, I acknowledge this. Stupid thing I did. But I'm going to learn from that. but I'm not going to carry that as a stick to beat myself over the back with. Now, what that fellow meant by not judging yourself, being kind, being forgiving to yourself. And that's why this kid, he saw this. It was just almost like his insight that is how to die well. Being someone who's not so judgmental, not so fault-finding. We use this word because this was a word which I read first in the teachings of the Buddha. And it's a beautiful word, a fault-finding mind. Because you see that so many people cultivate fault-finding minds. You can find fault with your work, you can find fault with your government, you can find fault with the weather, it's find fault with the Buddhist society, find fault with me, I tell stupid jokes. And you can find fault with yourself, you find fault with your partner, which means you can't live with anybody, you can't live with yourself, you can't live with life. And I've seen people with fault-finding minds, and they develop it to such an intensity, they get depressed. And sometimes that depression leads to suicide. And that's a tragedy. You can see where it comes from. Always finding fault, and never seeing. You know, that simile of the two bricks in the wall. If you don't know that, it's about time you bought my book. The left, the right, above and below, are two bad bricks in the wall down at Serpentine. I could only see the two bad bricks, and I needed someone actually to point out to the left, to the right, above and below, every bad brick are beautiful bricks. And seeing that, I realized I was a fault finder. I'd make one mistake in the wall of bricks which I laid, and that's what I would see. And I couldn't see anything else. You know, down at Serpentine Monastery, many of you have been there, and people kept on saying, what a beautiful monastery this is. It's so lovely here. I said, what? Can't you see the crack in the wall over there? Can't you see the sort of the leaves in the gutter which need to be cleaned? Can't you see the paving bricks which need to be fixed? Because I was the abbot. So as an abbot, I was the manager. So I was the one who had to see all the faults, fix this and fix that and fix someone else. And so I actually learned in the first years of that monastery how to be the fault finder. Because that's what a manager has to be, isn't it? You've got to find out what's wrong and fix this and fix that fault and fix somebody else's faults. And I realize that's a very dysfunctional mind state if you stay in that too long. When you fix up the faults in the office, then you start to fix up the faults in your partner. Do this, don't do that. This is how it should be done. No, don't do it this way. No, I know better. You do it that way. You can have, you know what I mean. That really creates a lot of pain in the relationship. And then I started doing it on myself, Ajahn Brahm. You know, you can never keep your robe on. Come on, you've been 35 years as a monk now, you should be able to keep your robe on. But after a while, you see, that was dysfunctional. So then I learned in a monastery to, sometimes I had to be the manager, look at the faults, but a lot of times I want to see my monastery the way that you see it. See its beauty. See its, you know, the way it's nice and peaceful and natural and wonderful. I stopped looking at the faults. The same in the meditation. When I first went to that monastery, you see all the dead trees there. I wanted to cut them all down. You saw all the weeds. They shouldn't be there. But no. People told me that in those dead trees, you know, from Jarrah Dieback, that's where the animals find their homes. Every part of that forest actually needs to be there. I never realized that forest. Even the dead stuff. That's important. It needs to be there. Anyone who studied ecology just knows how these things balance. And then I elaborated from that. Human beings, everybody needs to be here. Even the murderer. For some reason. Maybe it's because the monks can go and visit them in jail and practice their compassion. I learned so much by going into the prisons. I use everything to grow from, to learn from, whether it's taking funeral services or going into prisons or just laying bricks. Whatever you experience in life, you can learn from so much. In the prisons I realized that there's no such thing as a prisoner. There's no such thing as a murderer. There's no such thing as a rapist. There's no such thing as an adulterer. There's no such thing as a liar. There's just people who tell lies. But not all the time.
They're a person first and a murderer afterwards. It's only part of them, a small part of them. And somehow or other, we see the faults and we think that is the whole person. There's no such thing as a liar. People 99.9999% of the time tell the truth. But maybe that just one time is all we look at, we think of them and they're a liar. Just that brick, the wrong brick in the wall, that's a bad wall. When you see the big picture and wisdom, that's why I learn how to see the whole human being and see the whole of myself. Yeah, you're not perfect, but those things which aren't perfect, they're there for a reason. They almost make it beautiful. In that brick story, and the ending of that brick wall story was a beautiful little anecdote teaching the brick wall story to the Cancer Support Association over at Cottesloe. I just keep on looking after them for a long time. They're a great group. Teaching that afterwards, a builder came up to me and he said, "Ajahn Brahm, I want to tell you two things. First of all bricklayers make mistakes. I'm a builder, I have to put up with it all the time. All my bricklayers make mistakes, so don't feel bad about that. Even professional ones make mistakes." But then he told me the killer little piece of advice. He said, "Listen, this is a secret, but we'll tell you," and I've of course told everybody since. There's a great piece of advice. He said, "In the building industry," he said, "when we make a mistake like that, we tell our clients it's a feature. And we charge them an extra couple of $1,000s for it." And it's true. You know, all those idiosyncratic bricks which you have in your house, the things which go wrong, a good builder can turn it into a feature. It gives it unique, it gives it character. Just like you, with all your idiosyncrasies, whatever it's called, and all your little faults, you turn that into your features. That's who you are. That makes you lovable. And if you are so damn perfect, it will drive me insane. And it will drive the people you live with insane. So your little the little faults which human being has, that's what we learn from, that makes us human, that makes us worthy of love. What's the challenge to love someone who's perfect? To love someone because of their imperfections. To love life because it's not perfect. To love yourself and be at peace with yourself, even though you know you think there's something wrong with you. You know, one of the greatest insights you can ever have is to realize there's nothing wrong with me. That takes off a lot of stress, and you're perfectly okay. And just to be able to do things like that, you're learning about what life is, so you're at peace with yourself, you're at peace with life. You're having fun with this, and you're learning from it. Not with pain. I know that sometimes people say, "Oh, if you really want to sort of learn things, it has to be tough, no pain, no gain." I don't know where that sort of idea came from, but that is not Buddhism at all. That's not the spiritual life. Now, all the great spiritual teachers which I have lived with, they were just such fun to live with. And all the misery gut monks I ever knew, they all disrobed and they left because they weren't wise at all. And this is a very important point. Truth has to be happy. My love has to be joy. You can't be miserable and sort of, you know, say you're loving at the same time. And that's why, you know, part of my job is to take away that sort of that criticizing, that fault-finding, and also the fear which is generated by such fault-finding. Because as soon as you find faults in something, you're afraid of finding more, or you're afraid of somebody else finding out your faults, and you're afraid of going to hell. Somebody just wrote me this wonderful letter. They say they read my book, and it was the first book, so-called self-help book, which didn't tell them what to do. So how many people tell you what to do? Haven't you had it up to here with people telling you what to do? Instead of telling you what to do, say, "Be yourself. You want to go to sleep in the meditation? I'll just go to sleep. If you want to sort of walk in, walk out, oh, fine, it's free." So I try my hardest to not telling you what to do. So in other words, you can be free. So people think, "Ajahn Brahm is telling me to be free.
I'm not telling you that at all. Just be free. Because there's too many people just controlling rather than loving. And it's the most important point, that if you want to know how to live life, don't go telling yourself what to do, as you wouldn't tell what other people to do. Be kind to yourself, be gentle, be patient. And you'll find that this life just flows. Where it flows, who knows, but I'm here for the ride. It's like going some of these mystery tours. They used to have these mystery flights, apparently. You know, if it's Qantas or whatever, some years ago, you buy a ticket, really cheap, you don't know where you're going to end up. That's my life. That's your life as well. You know, you buy a ticket to human life, and you don't know where it's going to end up. The last place I ever thought I was going to end up was a monk sitting in front of all you guys, in front of a TV camera. No, even like being a monk was just, you know, not on my agenda when I was young. And certainly not a monk who goes teaching. If I was going to be a monk, I'd say I'd just like to live in a cave all my life, be the hermit. But you know, that's just not my... I say just go along for the ride and see what happens next. And that's your life, you know, the mystery tour, because the future is that mysterious. You don't know what's going to happen next. And that's what a wonderful way to live a life. In this moment, making this moment as beautiful, as happy, as peaceful, as kind, as generous as you possibly can. Sharing your life, like I'm sharing it with you now. Sharing these moments with all the people you like and love. And then, when you go home, I share it in my cave with myself. You know that wherever I am, I'm never lonely. Because I always realize there's always someone there. Me. And you know, I quite like me. So I'm a good friend to myself. You know why I like me, a friend? Because I can accept all my silly faults and stupid things, which I do. So when you accept yourself and at peace with yourself, and haven't got the fault-finding mind, but have a wider, loving, peaceful mind, oh, does life get so easy? Even when you meditate. And I've been meditating for hours in the next 3 months, seeing that some of those hours are going to be dull. Some are going to be beautiful, blissed out. Some are going to be, you know, thinking about what you're going to speak out at the next committee meeting next week. But whatever it is, even though I know I can't control all the things around me, I can always control my reaction to life. Whatever I experience, I know I can always make peace with it. Be kind, be gentle, and be patient. And that becomes just how I live life. Whatever you have to do, make peace. Be kind, be gentle, be patient. In other words, I don't find fault. I just do what needs to be done. And I know how to live life. And it also means when you meditate, sometimes, you know, you're sick. Amazing just how healthy. Even my monks, they've all had colds. I suspect it's swine flu, but I don't know. Who cares anyway? But it's strange. I mean, all those monks, no other monks are here this evening. I just come myself as I go back there tonight. You ask them, I'm the healthiest monk in the whole monastery. Even when I was a young monk in Thailand. I mean, this was when we're starting to eat all these really incredibly gross food. You know, the frogs on rice. I told the frog which peed on the rice another time. It's another gross story. It was frog soup. So this wasn't the big frog, it was the tiny frog. So just, you know these Chinese spoons, you could just put one on a spoon. And it was boiled. No garlic, no salt, no nothing, no vegetables. Just as if the frogs had just actually jumped in themselves. And you know, I was a vegetarian before I was a monk, but poor places like that, you had no choice. And that's all you had, frog soup and sticky rice. So a bit of sticky rice and on your spoon and in your mouth. Crunch. It was gross. But with even that gross food, I was always really healthy. Sometimes in the morning, the other monks would come up, you know, Ajahn Sumedho and all these other monks, he's coming here in December for a big conference at our Jhana Grove. He'd get up in the morning, he'd say, oh, I was on the toilet all night with diarrhea. He said, oh, so was I, said another monk. Another monk, yeah, me too. And I would say, not me. And even then I was incredibly healthy in those places. And I know why, it's one's attitude of mind. It's just this beautiful lot to find fault and be at peace, to be kind, to be gentle. The mind is incredibly powerful. And I know now, because I can feel my body, you know, such strong mindfulness. You know when the body's tired, you know how to relax and rest it. You know how I relax and rest my body? I just get out of the way. So you're with the body, okay body, you need some time by yourself. So I make myself really, really peaceful. No thinking, no orders, no complaints, no fault finding, no plans. Make mind very peaceful and calm. You feel the body start to really relax. And all this beautiful energy flows here and flows there. You don't do it, you don't make it happen, you don't stop it, you don't encourage it. You just get out of the way. You know, you're the biggest health problem for your body. You are. I think you know what I mean. You know, all the your worries and concerns and fault finding and wanting this and not being happy with that and just having to do this. What are you running so fast for? I think I said that last week. I said, sometimes people, I don't think I told this to the monks, sometimes I ask them, how's it going? And you say, you're getting there. Where are you getting? I know where you're getting. Karakata, Frio Cemetery, or Pinneroo. That's where you're getting. So slow down, so you can enjoy life and have a bit of a pause before you end up down those three places. As for me, I don't want to go to Karakata or Pinneroo or Fremantle. I decided when I die, I want to be recycled in a yellow bin. It's cheap and it's environmentally friendly. Can we do that? Or is that sort of against the rules? Ah, come on. All this recycling and green energy. It takes a lot of energy to cremate a person. And burying, it takes up too much land. A green recycling bin. Or even better, the mulcher. Ah, come on, it's only some sort of blood and bone. Put it on the garden afterwards. Anyway, maybe we can get some Buddhist cremation rituals allowed by the government one day, but I don't think so, but never mind. Anyway, sort of, when we know how to live well, you know, we can actually accept this moment, we can be kind, be gentle, and this is actually how I meditate. It means that meditation gets so easy, and I know when you die it's going to be so easy. Okay, so you're there in the bed. I was just visiting one guy just yesterday, just up in Meath Centre over in Kingsley. He's about to die. So I tell him how to die. But actually, I didn't really need to teach him a lot because he knew how to live. People know how to live. Oh, they know how to die. It's the same way. He was just so kind and generous in his whole life. Money didn't matter to him. And you know, he was looking after scouts and disabled people. Really a great guy. And all his family were around. He could see how much they really loved him. And there was a reason for that. A really great guy. I was just telling him, when you die, just make peace, be kind, be gentle, be generous to your body. Let your body do what it needs to do. You're a friend to the body. Remember what I said in the meditation? Your body is not a slave. So you keep on telling your body what to do. Come and get up now. You know, go to work, do this, run this and do that. Sometimes the way you treat your body is worse than the Marines with their prisoners in Guantanamo Bay sometimes. You torture your body sometimes. Be kind to your body. Make friends with your body. And then your body is likely to actually be more friendly to you, instead of being like a rebel and getting sick all the time. So be kind to your body. Just ask it, body, what do you want? How are you today? Remember, that's one of the things I say to myself when I first wake up in the morning. You know my first words in my cave when I wake up? Good morning. Hello again. Have a wonderful day, me. Now, that's no joke. Try that. It doesn't cost anything. It's easy to do. And it means it changes your whole day. Instead of, who I am again. Gee, not me again. Put some positive energy at the beginning of your day. And so, because you do things like that, I do that to my body as well. How are you going, old body? You okay? You know, when you ask questions like that, the body tells you what it needs. So sometimes you say, okay, I don't care how busy I am, my body says I need a break. So I take that break. That's why sometimes I've been here and say, no, enough now, I've got to go and take rest. And you do that to your body, because I feel the body, I know, you know exactly how it's going. So that way, when you're kind to your body, when you're sensitive to it, this is not my slave. So it's my friend, so I look after this. There was a fellow who was, I think, 96 years of age. I remember, I think I read this in the bulletin, an old Australian magazine. And they interviewed him, have you got any advice for other people on your 96th birthday? And it was a classic piece of advice. He said, if only I had known I was going to live so long, I'd have taken much better care of myself. You don't know how long you're going to live, so look after this body. It may have to last you a long, long, long time. And it's not like a car, you can't just trade it in and get another body without dying. So look after this body, be kind to it. Then you're knowing how to live. When you're kind to your body, when you're kind to yourself, when you're kind to life, of course when you're dying there, you're laying down there, you may have all these aches and pains. Okay, body, you know, I know what you're going through. It's just, you know, you're wearing out, that's okay. So you know, you just do it the best you can. You get out of the way. You relax. So people like that, it's amazing, I've seen them dying. And the doctors come up to me and say, I don't know what this person is doing. They should be in deep pain, crying and screaming, but they're just sitting there just with a smile on their face. I remember this one lady who was a great supporter of him. I remember Ratana. You know, she got lung cancer. And she was a bit short of breath, but you know, she's one of these beautiful people, a great mother, a great sort of Buddhist, always kind, always generous, never sort of was proud about what she did a huge amount. And when she had lung cancer, she rang me immediately. She just got the diagnosis. She was, I forget which hospital she was in. So she said, can you come? So I went immediately, got in the car, and went down into Perth, you know, maybe an hour. And when I went to see her, there she was lying in bed. Maybe an hour and a half, she'd just been told she's going to die. No treatment possible. And she was laughing and joking and saying, now this is what I want for my funeral. And can you do this and can you do that? And I always remember, you know, she said, and the other Thai people, because she was a Thai lady, she said, tell them not to come and see me now. They can go and see me when I'm in my box. And she started laughing, this silly joke. So maybe that's why I liked her so much, because she told silly jokes too. And after I went out of the room, it was actually the matron, or the senior sister, a very old Irish nurse. She said, come in here, please, come in here. I'm so glad you've come, she said. The lady you've just seen, she's in denial. She doesn't realize she's going to die. So come off it, she's just been planning a funeral with me. And this nurse, you could see just utter confusion. Because in all her years of nursing, she'd never seen anything like this before. Someone who's totally at peace with the fact she's going to die. And of course, those of you who knew Ratana know why she could do that, because that's how she lived. Even I mentioned about the chief monk in Malaysia, Dr. K. Sri Dhammananda. The doctor wrote this in his autobiography. When he was diagnosed with cancer, this monk just burst out laughing. And totally nonplussed the doctor. He said, I've been an oncologist, and that's the only time I've ever seen anyone who's told they got cancer laugh. Can you do that? Ah, come on. Number one, it's going to increase your immune system. You're going to have a much better chance of surviving the cancer when you laugh when you've told you've got cancer. You get miserable, then the cancer's going to grow immediately. Ooh, I've got cancer. We all know that, so why not laugh? It's the best thing you can possibly do. So now that's a person who lived a life like that. And so when you get these terrible, sort of so-called terrible announcements, it's easy. You can cope with no trouble. You're lying in the bed, about to die. Isn't it amazing? Do you really want to find out for sure about reincarnation? Soon you're going to find out. Isn't this exciting? So, and anyway, people are good people. You know what happens to good people. So why are people so afraid of death? What's wrong with death? Death is just needs a PR makeover. we should get some advertising firm to do advertisements on TV about death is okay. So people aren't so afraid and fed up with, you know, dying and death. And when we take that whole negativity away from dying, because we've taken the negativity away from life, you'll find you'll die so wonderful. And then your life will be a symphony with the best coming at the very end. Just like this evening, beautiful sunset. You know, up in Serpentine, we're on a hill. You see these wonderful sunsets. The Jhana Grove Meditation Center got a beautiful view. And you know the best part of the day are the sunsets. It's glorious golds and crimsons and purples streaking over the ocean. They only happen though when you've got a few clouds. You need imperfections to have beauty. If there's no clouds in the sky, you don't get these amazing sunsets. So a few imperfections there, streaking over the sky, over the Indian Ocean. And as that sun goes down, just beyond the horizon, this beautiful end of a day. It's one of my favorite times, just like the end of a life. The beautiful streaks of kindness and love. And people remember all the amazing things you did, what a great person you were, how kind, how generous, how you really helped and served and looked after, how you volunteered and were a committee member of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia. So you got a chance, don't miss it. And all the wonderful things you've done for other people, how you've forgiven people who just are so surprised that you could forgive them. And I don't think I mind telling the story, but just Rob, you know, he had his current wife is his second wife, and I think I should be okay telling this story, that his first wife down in Albany, so she didn't feel like it was good to come to his funeral because his current wife was here, and he didn't want to sort of upset things. You know what it's like with relationships now? Sometimes I wonder, people who say that everybody goes to heaven. Imagine, you know, you've had two or three husbands, or they've had a couple of wives, and you go up to heaven, they have to have lots of lawyers over there to settle everything. But no, it's a beautiful little story, because just that apparently the first wife in Albany didn't know he died when she had a dream about him. He came to her in a dream to ask forgiveness and say sorry. Anything which I did to upset you in those years we were together. And they said, you look so peaceful and so kind. A person understood about forgiveness, to make sure if you haven't done it before, do it when you die. To go to all those people you've known and loved, but you've had difficulty with, and ask forgiveness and give forgiveness. And I think the next day or two, she got the phone call that he died. And obviously, as far as I'm concerned, he went to visit her. It's a beautiful way of going. You know the last things which he was talking about just here last week? He was talking about how he wanted to help out with the orphanages we run. His mind was just full of charity, and Abby was telling me just before he came in here, he wanted to come and take the five precepts again. He'd already taken them on Waysak Day. So what a beautiful mind when you die. What a beautiful mind afterwards. He was a beautiful man. If you live well, you die well. So, now you've got the chance. Live as well as you can. And I don't mean just going around enjoying yourself and getting as much as you can from... But just be kind. Share your life with others. Be generous. Let go. Don't be fault-finding. Be peaceful, be kind, be patient. And then if you know how to live well, wow, you'll die so beautifully. And what a wonderful person you will be, right to the very end, until that sun goes down and all the golds and crimsons fade away into the darkness. But the sun comes up again tomorrow. But what a beautiful time that is, the end of a life well lived. Thank you for listening. And I dedicate that to Dr. Rob Despain. So has anyone got any questions about this evening's talk? Living well, dying well. please ask a question now, because I'm really discouraging people from queuing up and asking afterwards, because you know what happened last week to someone who queued up? We're not going to get many people asking questions afterwards. Yes. Yeah.
But how do I know that I don't have a reason to be afraid? What if I haven't been good enough? I mean, I'm not supposed to judge me,
judging me. Okay, great question. How can I not be afraid of death? How do I know I'm good enough? Have a look at yourself. And have a look at all the stupid things which you've done, Maggie, and all the rotten things which you've done in life, and say, okay, yeah, I've done all those stupid, terrible, rotten things. And then let them go. Bye-bye, rotten things. And you learn from them. You become a better person from them. And that way that you can remember all the beautiful things and all the kind things. And if you want to sort of up the good things and beautiful things, we've got donation boxes in the back. We need volunteers for... We're going to have volunteers for something soon. So if you really want to increase your good karma, stick around, because Dennis has got some opportunities for making more good karma. And you don't know when you're going to die. So, you know, Dev, you better make it quickly while you've got the chance. Now, this is an amazing thing with karma, some which I never understood for a long time, until you really get into your mind and understand all that bad karma, no matter what you've done, no matter how bad it is, you can let go of the lot. You don't have to carry it into the future with you. Now, I know that other religions, they actually prey on people's faults and make you afraid. And fear drives many religions. And I rebelled against that, and I was just so pleased to see that Buddhism was a spiritual path which does not have that. I'm talking about the real Buddhism. There's all sorts of Buddhisms around. The real Buddhism does not have guilt and punishment. But you will punish yourself. If you're not wise enough, you're thinking, I did this terrible thing, I deserve to be hurt. And it's a personal thing. And it's great you realize you don't have to do that. That you are totally free to forgive all of that. You don't have to go to a church and get a Jesus to forgive you, or a God to forgive you, or a Buddha to forgive you, certainly not a me to forgive you. I've got no... It's not right for me to forgive anybody. To encourage you to forgive yourself. That's my job.
So are you saying that if I forgive myself, the karma won't affect me?
Correct. And you'll be free. Oh, what a burden that is off your back. You can actually totally let it go. And be free. No punishment. That was just, wow, is that true? And it is true. And the thing is, you don't become a worse person. You become a much better person. The punishment makes people repeat the offence. It's a weird thing, weird psychology. Because the punishment means you're not good enough. There's something wrong with you. And that makes you just, again, act in an improper, cruel, selfish, stupid way. Lack of self-esteem or lack of self-worth creates a huge amount of pain in life. Love yourself, and you can love the whole world. Love yourself, and then you can love the whole world. Hate yourself, and you hate everybody. So you're free. Yes. Okay, you're with someone, they're very fault-finding, they're very negative and set in their ways. Don't find fault with them. So that's who they are. So you know, you're just patient, you just listen. Again, remember I told you before, that's what you've got two ears for. One in, one out. So you know, you can listen to them, but you don't take it personally. And they may sort of be very negative and call you names and be very, you know, you did this, you know, oh yeah, yeah, I did that, yeah, yeah, yeah. So it's this beautiful sense of you allow them to be themselves.
And this incredible thing happens when you allow them to be themselves and you're not reacting with negative voodoo back. You're not feeding into their cycle of negativity, and they get more peaceful. When they say you, see you're at peace with them, then there's a good chance they may become at peace with themselves. So you have to have this incredible strength. But it's not strength of willpower, it's the strength of love and wisdom. You allow them just to vent, to unwind, do whatever they need to do. And then they'll love you for that. Alas, is a person who understands me, they'll probably say. It will let me just let go of my pain. Because people have put that pain inside of them and they haven't let it go. Especially when they're very old, and it just comes out. It needs to come out. Let it come out. If you can do that, if you need a bit of time, if you're up to your level and you can't take any more, then sort of say, I need to go to the toilet or something. I need to go, whatever, just take a few minutes off. So you've got to be kind to yourself and know your limits as well. But you know that wonderful saying of teacher Ajahn Chah, when people are unloading on you like that, he always taught me, he said, you be a dustbin, Ajahn Brahm. So you allow people to put all their rubbish in you. He said, you be a dustbin, the most important part, a dustbin with a hole in the bottom. So you don't keep anything. It just goes right through you. So that when you walk away, you don't take that rubbish with you. It means you're always empty for another person to put their rubbish in. So that's what I feel like after the talk. I'm sitting here, dump your rubbish in here. And they dump it in here, and then another one comes and dumps some more rubbish, and more rubbish, and more rubbish. I'm always empty enough to take some more, because there's a hole in the bottom. Any other questions there? Okay, well, thank you for coming, and I wish you all happiness and well-being for the next couple of months. There have been a lot of great speakers here.